start with that year of 1944 when you got started in baseball.
All right, 1944, I was 16 years old, going to Addison High School up in Addison, New York. And a fellow named Paul Wing Wildrick was a young man in town. He was somewhere in his 60s at that time. Used to come down to this high school and hit pepper to a fellow named Frank Heidrick and myself. And we played and played. And I got to where I was pretty good at handling that glove and the ball. And so he wrote a fellow that was ahead of the Yankee scouting system at that time. His name was Paul Critchell. Paul Critchell made a trip to Addison my junior year to see this young phenom, I guess, that Wing Wildrick had been talking about. He came up there and he saw me play evidently two or three games and in a state tournament. So he approached me about wanting to play professional baseball. And I said, I'd love to. That was my whole dream since I was 5 years old, is to play professional ball and play in the big leagues. So he approached my mother, and of course my mother said, no, there's no way he's going to do that. I want him to graduate from high school. And I said, well, Mom, you know, I'll graduate from high school. I'll come back and graduate with my class. So anyway, what happened was he talked to the principal of the school, my teachers, the postmaster, and everybody. Addison is a town of 1,700 people at that time. It's now about 2,200. It's in the dairy farming country, just southeast of Buffalo, about 60 miles. So anyway, they got the townspeople together, and everybody was kind of excited about it. So I went back and approached my mom, and I said, yes, Mom, I swear I will come back and graduate with my class in 1945. She said, well, okay. I said, but you know, you won't stay because you get homesick just going across town to stay with your at your sister's house. I said, no, I want to go. I want to play. I'll be all right. So anyway, to boil down, she went ahead and let me sign. She signed, of course, with me because I was being 16 years old. And I went to Wellsville, which was right up the road about, oh, I guess maybe 70 miles, 60 miles, something like that, New York, in the old Pony League, which was the New York Penn League at that time, and started my baseball career. And it was exciting. And that first year I went out and played and done very well. I hit .336, which is a matter of record, and came back. After the season, everything was fine. Went to school in the fall, worked with my class, and took my final examination and everything in January. So I had enough credits. All I lacked, I think, was a half a credit from January into June for graduation to complete my graduation points that I needed. So it was an easy breeze from then on as far as getting my diploma. But I'd made the promise to my mother that I would stay and graduate with my class, so I did. And then it was about halfway through the season by the middle of June when we graduated. So then I had to go to see Mr. Critchell again, and he said, well, you've been promoted to Binghamton, which was in the Eastern League, Class A ball, but breaking into Class A in the middle of the season is pretty tough, so you may be sitting on the bench a lot. We'd rather have you playing because, you know, you're new, young and new, and you need to be playing. You don't need to be sitting on the bench. So they said, will you go back and play at Wellsville? And I said, I don't care where I go as long as I'm playing. Well, they paid me $110 a month to play baseball. It was more money than I'd seen in my whole life up to that point in time. Never seen a $100 bill until I was 30 years old, I guess, anyway. But I went back to Wellsville that year, finished up, played pretty well, joined the ball club, and, of course, they put me right in the lineup. And we played in Hornell at that time. Well, it was Hornell, Batavia, Lockport, Erie, Pennsylvania, Bradley, Pennsylvania, Olean, Wellsville. That was the league. So I toured that lead, and I done very well, and they were pleased. So I came back, and before the next season started, I went into service. Well, I stayed in the service 2 years. I played ball while I was in the service, which was a blessing for me. That's one reason I joined the Army. I didn't join the Navy because there wasn't no place to play out there in that ocean. So I joined the Army, got in there and played at Camp Lee, Virginia, had a great team. In fact, we had a championship team. We won the section or the regionals up there and went to Wichita, Kansas in the big semi-pro baseball tournament out there and finished fourth. General Graham was in charge of our group, and he was a great baseball fan and friend, and we just had a super time out there and finished fourth, won the Best Sportsmanship Award for the tournament, which was very pleasing to the Army in those days. So we came back from them.
Who were some of the players on that team?
Well, we had some former major leaguers on there. Granny Hamner was there. He used to play shortstop for the Phillies back when I was with the Phillies. We had a fellow named Joe Nelson who went up with the Phillies for a while. He's from Pennsylvania. We had Bob Shackley's, who was a pitcher with the Cleveland Indians. And, oh gosh, I'd have to really dig back in my memory to think that far back. You're asking me to remember something happened in 1945, 46, a long time ago. But there were some great players, and we had a great ball team. And Artie Hoke, who was a shortstop for Wake Forest in those days, and later got a tryout, I think, with Pittsburgh or somebody, and his son is a professional golfer right now on the PGA Tour. He was our shortstop. He beat Granny Hamner out for shortstop. Hamner had to play third, and I played second because I was a third baseman at the time. So anyway, we had a great time there, and I went through the service. I got out of service and reported to Binghamton in 1948. From Binghamton, had a pretty decent year. They got in real bad shape, and they wanted to send me up, so they sent me to Newark in the International League at the end of the year. I went down there, and they wanted to keep from losing 100 games. Well, we did. We lost 99. So I don't know if I had anything to do with helping them not lose 100 or not. I'm really not sure about that. But anyway, 49, went back to spring training with Newark. It looked like I was going to be with them. And right there on opening day, they sent me back to Binghamton. So I was of course, an unhappy camper then, as I thought. I had everything arranged at there, and I had outplayed. They had some bonus ball players, though. And we had seven infielders on that Newark team, the Newark Bears at the time. Six of them bonus players. So guess who got sent out? And so my $110 a month didn't amount to a whole lot. By then, I was all the way up, I think, to $350. But anyway, from there, I went out to Muskegon, Michigan. And because I had such a good throwing arm, they thought the Yankees thought I'd make a pitcher out of me. So I went ahead and give that a whirl. I ended up with a 5-5 pitching record for the season, but we were losing guys here and there, and the Korean thing was just getting started. And so we lost several of our young players, and I played short for a while. Then I went in the outfield, and I really liked playing in the outfield, but I took my turn at pitching. But anyway, I started five ball games and lost all five. So then they put me in relief, and I won five. So I ended up with my pitching career at Muskegon, Michigan in 1950, 5-5 pitching record. Now, that season ended, and I was really kind of disgruntled, but they called me back there, and they gave me a raise in pay. So I said, well, I'm going to hang in there, but I'm not going to pitch. I refuse to pitch. It hurts my arm anyway, and I didn't want to hurt my arm. I knew that arm was valuable to me as a player. So I went back and I played shortstop and third base in the outfield. Then I hit .379. Well, that opened up some eyes. And so the next year I went in 52, I went to Beaumont, Texas, in the Texas League. And that was good. That was double A ball. And I was still kind of discouraged. I was supposed to go to Kansas City, which at that time was a Yankee farm club, but something happened, and there again I think the bonus players was part of it. So anyway, I ended up going to Beaumont. And Harry Kraft was the manager down there. And I got down there and I said, I'm not playing every position on this ball club, so I want to be an outfielder. I feel good in the outfield. And he said, okay, you're going to be my left fielder, and I'll work with you. And Harry was a great center fielder for the Cincinnati Reds in his career. So he got me out there in that outfield, and I played, and he taught me, and we worked every day and fought the mosquitoes and everything else down there. And as a result of that, incidentally, Whitey Herzog was our center fielder, who was a great manager with St. Louis. So anyway, I worked that, and here come Roger Hornsby and Gabe Paul. And the Yankees, I was still Yankee property at that time, and the Yankees were looking for a pitcher. And Cincinnati had the pitcher they wanted, what Stengel told me later, who was Ewell Blackwell. So he said, I wanted Ewell Blackwell to win me 40 or win me four ball games at the end of the season. So the end of 1952, I was having a good year down there in Beaumont, doing real good. So Gabe Paul and Rogers Hornsby came down there, and Hornsby saw me play against that their team, in which was Tulsa in the Texas League. And he liked what he saw. I ran out of bunt. Everybody hustled a la Pete Rose in those days. If you didn't, you wouldn't have a job. Now, you know, if they run, get them to run 90 feet, you're lucky. But anyway, he saw me play, and I got a base on balls and run to first base, and I hit a home run over the fence and all. And Roger told Gabe Paul, that's the guy I want in the trade. So the trade was made, and they called me up. So Harry said, okay, Jim, you've been traded to Cincinnati, and as soon as you get that 100th RBI, you can go.
What was Hornsby's position with the Reds at that time?
Hornsby was the manager. He had just been signed on as a manager. I think Freddie Hutchins was there, if I'm not mistaken, before him. Now, I could be wrong on that.
The records I've got show that Joe Sewell.
Might have been Joe Sewell. Okay. Joe Sewell. Probably was Joe Sewell. I don't recall because I really wasn't paying any attention to them. I was just
didn't cross paths with
getting
them.
My stuff together. You know, I wanted to get to the big leagues. So anyway, Roger says, you're the guy. And so I come up to bat. I forget the date now, but anyway, it was the latter part of 1952. So I forget the date. But anyway, I come up and the bases were loaded. And no, there was runners on first and second. And I needed three RBIs to get my 100. So I got up there and I got a good fastball up and I hit it out of the park. I turned the bases and I knew it was my 100th RBI. I kept track of that. I come across the plate. Everybody, of course, screaming, come in the dugout. And Harry Kraft said, Jim, just keep right on going. Head for Cincinnati, pal. It's been great. You had a great season, and good luck to you. I never actually stopped in the dugout. I just went right on through, shook everybody's hand, said goodbye. Went in the clubhouse, got my shower, got my clothes changed, stepped out. I had my clothes already packed in the car anyway. I took to the ballpark every day, packed. And got in my little Studebaker Champion, what I owned that day. And back to Atlanta I came. Got home, spent a night, they had tickets for me, the airplane, flew into New York, met Gabe, signed a contract, went up to Boston. The last year, the Boston Braves were in Boston. Joined the club up there, and at the late 80s, about the fifth inning, I think, of a twi-night doubleheader. And I got dressed, they had my uniform and everything waiting for me, of course. I got in there and got dressed, went on to the bench. Hornsby told me to come on down and sit down beside him. He asked, the first things out of his mouth was, I'll never forget this. I probably made the greatest statement I ever made. He said, you ready to play, kid? And I said, hell yes, that's what I came here for. He said, good, get a bat. So you're going to pinch hit in this game, and you're going to start the next one. I grabbed that bat, and I was ready to go. So that's how I got started in the big leagues. And I pinch hit against Warren Spahn. Well, I'll tell you this little story about that first time in the big leagues for a rookie. Was I stepped up to that plate, and there's Warren Spahn pitching, and Del Rice was the catcher. I got in there and got ready to hit, and my right leg just started going boom, 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 like Thumper the Rabbit. I backed out. Well, this went on for three or four times. I stepped out, cleaned my wiped my face, cleaned my cleats. Jock O'Connell was the umpire. Great umpire. Jock O'Connell come around Del Rice in front of the plate, took his brush out and was brushing it off, and he looked up at me and he says, hell, kid, let him throw the ball once and we'll be here all night. So I said, okay. So Jocko went back around. He never tried to show me up or anything. He just kind of glanced up at me and said, hell, kid, let him throw the ball once. Everything will be all right. But we'll be here all night. Okay. So he got back around. So I just grabbed the ground with my cleats, hung in there. He got that first pitch through me. When that ball went by me, that ended all my anxiety, all my nervousness, and I felt I belonged there at that moment. Why, I have no idea, but it did. It just went right out of my body, and I was perfectly relaxed. I fouled about three pitches off, and then Jocko made a bad call on an inside slider, and I was called out on strikes. And I say to this day, it was a bad call. Jock said, well, it was close enough, he should have hit it. And Roger Hornsby said, the ball was, if it's close enough for him to call a strike, he should have hit it. And I said, okay, I was wrong. I should have hit it. So,
well, that debut of yours, I'd like to hear a lot more about that. You may not know, but baseball historians have said that your first partial year in the big leagues is one of the 10 or 11 best debuts ever.
Yeah, I guess
you
it was.
You tore up the league. And, you know, people are still talking about it.
Well, I guess that's probably right, although at the time I really didn't think anything about it. But anyway, after striking out, I come back to the bench and the guy says, don't feel bad, kid. He's only struck out 200-something this year. I said, I'm ready to go this next ball game, you know. So Max Surkamp, big right-hander, was pitching the next ball game. So I get in there. I'm playing left field. And I'm not nervous. I'm out there playing. And first time up, I hit a screaming line shot right up the middle. Base hit. Drove in a run. Well, anyway, we ended up winning the ball game. I think something 4-3 or 3-2 or something like that. I drove in all the runs and got 3-for-4. And from that moment on, I would just, Hornsby, he'd just look at me and laugh, say, I told you it was better. He said, the lights are better, the field's better, the players are better, the pitchers have better control. He said, well, hell, even the coffee tastes better. And I loved it. I loved it from that moment on. I was like I just come home or went to heaven or something. I was just delighted. Then I went on. We went from Boston. Of course, that was the last game of our series with them. Then we went to, I believe, went to the Polo Grounds. And we're out there before the Polo Grounds. See, that's the biggest ballpark I ever seen. They put the whole town of Addison right in that ballpark. You know, it still had plenty of room left over. I'd never seen such a place. So Roger came to me and said, Jim, he says, you're the best outfielder I got, so you're going to play center field today. Center field? I just learned to play left. He said, no, you're going to play center. Get out there during batting practice and field some balls and get the feel of it. And I went out there. And that center field was so long, and the hitter looked like he's about 3-4 inches high. It was a huge place to me. I had never seen nothing like it. But I worked out there, and I said, boy, I need help. So Cal Abrams was playing right field, and Willard Marshall was in left field. And so I said, you guys give me all the help you can. And I said, yeah, we'll help you. Don't worry about it. We'll place you in the ring. So anyway, we got through that ball game pretty good. And went on. I think we played two games there. I think that series was cut short for some reason or other. They played two games. Then went over to Brooklyn in Ebbets Field. And boy, I'll tell you, there's a park that I loved. Come up, and I don't know, I guess maybe the third or fourth inning. I'm forgetting now just what it was. But I was hitting behind big Ted Kaczewski. Now, we had Ted Kaczewski, Roy McMillan, Johnny Temple played second. Two great double play combinations. Should be in the Hall of Fame for what they can do out there on that bag. Bobby Adams played third. I was playing left field. He put me back in left. Gus Bell was playing center, and Willard Marshall and Bob Borkowski switched off in right field at that time. So about the third inning, we get runners on second and third. A clue comes up, so Charlie Dressen was the manager of the Dodgers. Charlie walks. Clue to get to this rookie kid. So he calls on it, and they told me about this. I didn't know anything about it. They told me afterward that Charlie got on the clubhouse or on the dugout telephone and called long distance to Bobby Bregan down in Oklahoma. I see. Well, I forget what their farm club was down there now. Whatever it was, Fort Worth. Fort Worth was their farm club. And called Bregan and asked him how to pitch to this kid Greengrass. So I don't know. It's on, can't keep the fastball high and tight, and the curveball's low and away. Probably that's what they taught how to pitch everybody. So anyway, Johnny Rutherford was pitching. So the second pitch he threw me, I hit in the upper deck for my first major league home run, which was a grand slam. Herman Wiemeyer was our pitcher that day. Herman went on and shut him out, and we beat him 4-0. And I don't think I touched the ground the rest of the season. It was my first really big blow. I had hits before. But when that ball went up in that upper deck off of him, I just felt so good. Then the next day, Carl Erskine was pitching. Now, there's another guy that's just a tremendous pitcher. Carl had probably the greatest changeup there ever was in what we call a real downer curveball. I mean, he could throw good, and he threw hard. And I came up with two men on against Carl. And he threw me his curveball, and I parked that in the same place in the upper deck. So I knew that before hitting off on a lesser-known person as Johnny Rutherford, and hitting against one of the greats of that day, Carl Erskine, and getting a home run, that there may be something to this. Maybe I do belong here. Maybe, you know, this is where I... And I went on, and from there, I think we went to Cincinnati. Never got to play in Crosley Field that year. Our season at Crosley Field was over, but we did stop there on an off day going to St. Louis. And I got to see Crosley Field. And, of course, when you walk into Crosley Field, you just fell in love with it. They've built a replica of it now in Blue Ash, up in just north of Cincinnati, kind of a suburb of Cincinnati. Beautiful. The ground, the terrace in left field that Hornsby run me up and down later on 100 times every day. The old scoreboard, everything is there. And there's even 500 or 600 of the original seats that were in the stands that are there. And it's a public park, and it's just beautiful. And anyway, when you walked into Crosley Field, you had to love it because the surface was just garden trim. Like, it was like Matty Schwab, who was the grounds caretaker there, had taken a comb and scissors and trimmed the grass and the baselines and everything. It was just a gorgeous place to play. But anyway, went on to St. Louis. And in St. Louis, I got lucky, and Stu Miller was pitching. Now, if you remember about Stu Miller, not a lot of people remember him as the kid that got blown off the mound with the Giants in the World Series.
Right, the jump ball pitcher.
Yeah. And he threw me one of them 10-count curveballs he threw so many times, and I hit it off the scoreboard in left field out there. It was the first home run that had been hit off of him all year. So that kind of opened up some eyes, and they told me this, which at the time didn't mean anything to me anyway. But that was... that was pretty good. But anyway, that was it. And then from St. Louis, I don't remember. I think that we ended up the season. Anyway, I played something like 17 ball games or whatever the record says. I'm not for sure what it was, but I had...
It says 18. You're awful close.
18. Well, I know it was something somewhere in there, but I can't remember all of that. And I had 5 home runs and 27 RBIs. As a matter of fact, I had more RBIs than some of the guys that had been on that club the whole year. I remember Hornsby making that statement in the clubhouse, kind of embarrassed me, but I, you know, at the time.
So there was no question about your being on the team the next year?
No, I think I established myself as being ready to play. And, of course, the next year, boy, I worked hard all winter and went to spring training in July shape. You might say I was ready to play opening day of spring training. I worked hard all winter and run up and down banks at the Atlanta Reservoir and had kids throwing me batting practice and all kinds of stuff. And I just worked all winter long.
Had your parents moved to Atlanta from Addison?
My dad had passed away when I was 2, so he never got to see me play. My mother came the following year, 1953, my rookie year. She came to Pittsburgh twice, or 3 times. And each time she came to the ballpark in Pittsburgh, I hit a home run. And I told her, I'm going to pay you to travel with me. But every time she attended a ball game that I played in the big leagues, I hit a home run in that particular game, which, no great big thing, but it was something to me, and it meant a whole lot to her. And it was just, that was really something. And 53, of course, my rookie year, and I had a very good year my rookie year, 27 home runs, 100 RBIs, and I don't know what else.
Well, 173 hits is pretty respectable, too, 86 runs.
Oh, well, I thought I had enough, and some of the guys on our ball club thought I should have been rookie of the year that year. Junior Gilliam was voted rookie of the year, and I don't even know where I finished in the voting. And yeah, I never bothered to look. I didn't get it. But the year for the 18 games that I played at the end of 52, the Sporting News elected me to their rookie all-star team, or whatever it was at that time. I think it was a rookie all-star team. And they had voted me onto that team as a result of those 18 games. But the next year, I everybody on our club at Cincinnati thought that I had a real shot, but they say you can forget about it because if you don't play with New York, the Yankees, the Dodgers or the Giants, you can forget it, because that was the center of the news media, and those guys got all the publicity. Everybody in the country knew those guys because they were all over the radio and everything, in places like Cincinnati and St. Louis, and even Chicago in that time, didn't have that national coverage. So, anyway, I didn't get Rookie of the Year, but I would love to have it, but it didn't matter to me because I was playing in the big leagues, and that was my dream. So I fulfilled my boyhood dream of when I was about 5 years old that I wanted to play in the big leagues, and I accomplished that, and I'm very proud of that fact. And it was great, and I got to play in two consecutive Hall of Fame games. One was Cincinnati in 1954, and then I was traded in the early part of 55 to the Phillies, and the Phillies played a Hall of Fame game in Cooperstown, and I got to play in that game. So I got to go to Cooperstown twice. And I played there, and I could always say, did you make the Hall of Fame? And I said, yeah, I made it 2 years in a row.
What did the Reds get for you from the Phillies?
They traded me. The Yankees got Yul Blackwell. All right, they got a pitcher named of Ernie Neville. They got an outfielder named of Bob Marquez. Ernie Neville, Bob Marquez, and myself, and probably some money for Blackie. Now, I think that was the total deal. Don't hold me to that because I may be wrong. I may have left somebody out, but I don't. If I did, I just plain don't recall. But I know Ernie Neville was a pitcher, right-handed pitcher with us, and Bob Marquez, who was an outfielder, a fleet-footed center fielder. Oh, he could go. He was from North Carolina. Boy, he could fly. And myself. And Blackie went to. Got the rookie year over with.
Yeah.
But I really had my confidence in after 53, though. I really did feel that I belonged, and according to what everybody was telling me, and Hornsby was very pleased, and Gabe Paul was very pleased, so I felt, you know, well, I've worked all my life up to this point, and now I finally made the big leagues, and I'm just tickled to death to be here. And it's a funny thing, and I haven't mentioned it only one time, and that's my starting salary of $130 or $110 a month. I have that contract in a frame. But money never became an object with me.
You must have been pretty fast. I see you had 7 triples in 1953, and that's a lot of triples nowadays, sir.
Well, I could move. I think I had a knack for running the bases. I never failed to score from second base on a base hit. And I was fast for a big guy. And Roger Hornsby, and I didn't look fast, but I could cover a lot of ground. And I think that's what Roger Hornsby liked about the whole deal with it. But I was a big guy, and I had power. I had two things going for me. I had power, I was strong, I had a good arm, and I had the guts of a burglar. But nothing frightened me. I wasn't afraid of anything. And that was a big plus for me at that time.
There were a lot of power hitters on the Cincinnati teams.
We had Kazuski, of course. Mm-hmm. Huge mountain of a man. Great, great, great power hitter. And Temple and McMillan, we set the home, I think we set a home run record or come close to it in 1953. And they each had 10 or 12 home runs. Gus had 30-some home runs. Kluge was in the 30s. Andy Siminick was our catcher. He was in the 20s. Wally Post was a 20 and better home run hitter. And Bobby Adams hit 10, 15 home runs. So we had everybody in our lineup just about could hit the ball. Our problem wasn't getting runs. Our problem was holding the other team. We'd score 8, they'd score 10. That's how it worked. But we had a great team, and I really enjoyed every minute of it. I was just tickled to death to be in the big leagues.
Did Rogers Hornsby talk much about hitting? Of course, he was such a great hitter.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, Roger Hornsby would set up and talk all night baseball with you, all night long and into the next day if you want to. You change the subject to something else, and he'd just get up and leave. He loved the game of baseball. He was at the ballpark every morning before 10 o'clock in his uniform sitting in the dugout. He may be the only one there, him and the birds and the beasts. Can we cut this? Let me get that.
Rogers Hornsby and hitting is where we were.
Oh, Roger Hornsby was the greatest. 1953, we're in spring training. Ted Kaczynski, to that point in time, had never hit more than 21 home runs in his entire career. Roger was watching Clue hit in spring training. And he asked Clue one day, we're all sitting there talking about hitting and everything. And he said, Clue, I want you to, in batting practice, just instead of swinging down at the ball, swing level. If you hit that ball on the upper side of that bat, you're going to get, it goes in the air, it's going to go forever. You got such tremendous power. Because he hit some of the most vicious line drives you ever was. You couldn't imagine how hard he hit that ball. So he got him to swing level. Well, and as a result of that, the first year, 1953, I think he hit well into the 30s. And then the following year, he hit 40-something. And then he hit, Rogers left the ball club, and I don't think Clue ever topped 40 again. And then later, of course, later on, he was traded to the White Sox and went on to get to play in a World Series, won a pennant. But Clue was a monstrous man, and he just had such great power. He could be completely fooled on a pitch and turn loose the bat with one hand, just hit the ball with one hand, knock it out of the ballpark. Tremendous power. But Roger Hornsby was the greatest right-hand hitter to ever play the game, in my opinion. And I think the greatest left-hand hitter that I ever knew, in my opinion, was Ted Williams. And those two guys, if there was a game in the balance or you needed somebody to put that bat on the ball, either one of those guys up to that plate would be almost guaranteed. They're going to hit that ball hard somewhere. And that's all Roger ever said about hitting was to hit the ball hard. Keep your eye on the ball and try to hit it right back at the pitcher, because that's the biggest area of the field to get a base hit in. He's only 60 foot 6 inches away from you. Once it's past him, it's wide open spaces. But of course, then they got to play in shifts and stuff like that, you know, and change that a good bit. But he just said, just try to hit that ball and try to get a base hit every time you go to the bat. Every time you swing that bat, intend to hit that ball. And he hated it for a guy to take one of them weak halfway swings. He said, when you get here and you swing that bat, let it go. And if you miss the ball, so you miss it. But at least if you swing and you got a good swing and you hit it, you're going to hit it hard. And if you hit it hard, it's got a chance of being a base hit. So don't ever give them little half swings and all that. If you make up your mind to swing, let her go. And that's the way he taught hitting.
Could you describe the way you grip the bat in your stance?
Well, I was kind of an open stance. My legs were low, my feet were medium apart. I kept the bat straight up and down and back, and with my right or my left shoulder down, and my head turned fully around where I could see the pitcher with both eyes. You'd be amazed at the guys that don't hit well, and wonder why, because they're only looking at the ball with one eye until it gets about halfway there, for the other eye actually picks the ball up. So what we used to give ourselves a little test. In batting practice, we'd get in there and get ready, then we'd just let loose the bat and put your hand up over this eye. And nine times out of ten, you wouldn't see the pitcher with your right eye, as being a right-hand hitter. And so you get the head turned where you can see the ball with both eyes. That was one thing that Roger always said. Look at the ball with both eyes, and don't take your eyes off the ball. In fact, he liked you to see the ball hit the bat. Now, so many guys that have played for years and said, I never saw the ball hit the bat. Well, maybe not in their conscious mind, but in their unconscious mind, it was such a flicker, you know, just so fast that you actually see it. And if you really concentrated hard, you could see that ball hit that bat.
I think Ted Williams said he could see
it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or vice versa. I should say the bat hit the ball. Yeah.
Right. And Williams, they had some great eye exercises at that time, and guys just don't, you know. They were professional guys. Like I say, money never come into our thoughts when we were playing ball. Nobody ever discussed money. We knew if we played well and had a good year, we were going to get money. We were going to get money and be fairly fair about it. Sometimes it wasn't, but depends on the person. What satisfies one doesn't always satisfy another. But I never worried, never argued about money or anything. I was thankful they sent me a contract to sign.
Was Bob Carpenter the owner of the Phillies when you were with...
Yes, Mr. Carpenter was owner of the Phillies when I was traded over to the Phillies.
And who owned the Reds? I don't know where to
Mr. Crosley from Old Crosley Field. His family, he had passed away. His family were the owners there. And then later on, I think in the later 50s, that it went into some kind of corporation or something, and somebody got a syndicate up or however it was, and they bought it. But it was owned by Crosley when I first joined him there. He started out his business as a washing machine and mechanic in a little old hole in the wall store. That's where he got the appliance, and then he built the appliance, of course, and went on to make money, and then he bought the ball club. The great owner. They weren't exactly spendthrifts. They didn't pay players a lot of money, but you had wonderful place to play. Crosley Field, you couldn't ask for a better place to play baseball than Crosley Field.
A lot of the fields that you played on in the National League are no longer there.
That's
something that you said Crosley was your favorite field to play.
By far.
Which did you like the least?
The least, the Polo Grounds. It wasn't built for my favor because it was such a huge park, but it was deep in right and left center field to center field, 490 foot in center field. Then come around, it was very short down the lines. It was only 250 down the lines to the edge of the little overhang that they had there in the stands. But if you were in a dead pull hitter or hit the ball the opposite way down the lines, there was no chance. I mean, I hit a ball in the Polo Grounds one day, and the clubhouses were in dead center field. And you had steps going up this way into the clubhouse. Well, there's a cutout there between the bleachers where you went in, and it was pretty wide. I guess it was probably, I don't know, 50, 60 foot wide, maybe longer, maybe bigger than that. But it's a big opening there, dead center field. And back inside of that, before you went up the steps of the clubhouses, was a statue of Tug McGraw. Or not Tug, but
John
McGraw. And it's a beautiful bronze statue there and a monument honoring him. Well, I hit a ball one day in the air. Willie Mays is playing center field. And I got to second base and looked out there, and he's standing out there by that statue and caught the ball. And I'm standing on second base. I could not believe it. That was the hardest hit ball I ever hit, the longest probably I ever hit, and he caught it. Had it been 20 feet this way or 20 feet the other way, it would have been in the seats for a home run. But it was in that opening, dead center field, back past where we'd go in, and he went back in there and caught it. But Willie Mays was a tremendous outfielder, just best probably all-around ball player that I ever seen play. I mean, he could do everything. Willie could do absolutely. He could run. He could hit. He could throw. He could steal bases. He had great instincts. And he could go get that ball in the outfield. And he could hit that ball. He was just a great all-around ball player.
You had mentioned Ted Williams being the best left-handed hitter you had seen. Mm-hmm. Who were the best hitters in the National League?
The best hitters in the National League? Well, number one, Stan Musial. Stanley, probably the greatest as far as the National League was concerned that I ever saw. Now, there may have been others, but not as far as I'm concerned, the ones that I saw or know about. Stan Musial he was unbelievable. Not a great big guy. Not a great big guy. About your size, about built like you. Not a muscular type of guy, but looked like you see him in his street clothes and looked more like a businessman, you know, that you would see him running some executive in the business office. But boy, he could hit that ball. And he had that peekaboo stance. And who's to say, probably the worst hitting instructor that could ever possibly be. That's the way you got to hit, son. You know, duck behind your arm here. But he was such a great man and a great person. We had a favorite saying, and we called him the poor Pollock, because, of course, Stanley was Polish. But he made more money than anybody in the league, and should have, rightly so. But in those days, $40,000 was the top salary. And he and Williams were the guys that got that kind of money. And everybody else was in the teens somewhere, you know, from 10 to 20. And but, oh, boy, he was a great hitter. Whitey Lockman, I always thought, was a great. He hit against us. Well, all the Giants hit against us. But Whitey Lockman was a good hitter. Snyder Duke was a good hitter. Carl Furillo, played right field for the Dodgers, was a good right-handed hitter. very good. In fact, he led the league 1 year, although I didn't think he deserved it because he set the last week out. But still, he was a good hitter.
Would you agree that Perillo had the strongest arm of anybody in the league?
No. No, and I'll tell you why. Ebbets Field, you have to be familiar with Ebbets Field. He got that reputation in Ebbets Field, but Ebbets Field was a short field, high fence, concrete at the bottom. And what Ferrullo would do is he played that fence and that wall like an expert. And he had a good arm. I'm not saying he didn't have a good arm. He had a major league arm. But as far as a great arm, you're talking about guys that could throw that ball right through the wall. But Ferrullo had a strong, accurate arm. And he'd play that ball off that thing, whirl around, and of course the distance wasn't that far, probably 320, 325, and bingo, in the second base. And he'd nail guys trying to make a double. But he learned to play the wall. He was a great defensive outfielder off that wall, playing the wall, which you don't see nowadays. They don't know how to play wall. They don't practice, that's why, but he practiced. And I watched him, and that's why. But no, he didn't have the greatest arm. The greatest arm I ever saw on a guy was on Glenn Gorbis, who was a Canadian and just passed away this past year. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine was traded from Cincinnati to the Phillies when I went to the Phillies. Andy Simenik and I was traded to the, and Glenn Gorbis was traded to the Phillies for Smokey Burgess, Steve Ridzik, and another player, and I don't recall the other player's name. But it was, but he could throw, he took a ball behind home plate in Old Shied Park in Philadelphia and threw it over the scoreboard in right center field, out of the ballpark, which is some 340 feet to the base. And that scoreboard went up probably 40 foot in the air. And he threw that sucker over the top of it from behind home plate. And, but he could throw from the outfield. He threw clotheslines from the outfield. He had a great arm. He was a Canadian boy and ex-hockey player. And he run like a duck. He run funny. Everybody made fun of the way he run because of his skating. I guess his feet were out. Like a run like a web foot, but he could run good. But he had such a tremendous arm. Rocky Calavito, Cleveland, whew, tremendous arm. Al Kaline with the Tigers had a great throwing arm, a strong throwing arm. And I put Ferrullo in their class, but not maybe a step below, a notch below as far as power goes, strength goes. But as far as accuracy, I put Ferrullo probably was the most accurate in Ebbets Field, anybody that ever played in Ebbets Field that I ever saw play anyway, because he was just absolutely unbelievable.
What about pitcher? I'm going to turn this over.